1 Samuel 23-24, the 18th talk in a series in 1 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on January 4, 2009 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at 1 Samuel chapters 23 and 24 today. Before we get into the passage, I want to give you a little archaeological update. I'll give you a report on how I spent my Christmas vacation. I got a new issue of Biblical Archaeology Review, and there's an article in here that's somewhat relevant to what we're doing, so I want to tell you about it. I haven't taught out of 1 Samuel for over a year, so it's been a while back, but when I started, I mentioned that there's this controversy among archaeologists with respect to whether David and Solomon actually existed, whether the accounts in the Bible are even remotely historically accurate. And there are two camps with respect to that. There are the minimalists. They're the ones who question the historicity of the biblical accounts. And there are the maximalists who tend to give the biblical account the benefit of the doubt. But the dominant group is the minimalists. And in particular, it's David that they would say is not a historical figure, that there was no state of Israel at the time of David. There was no organized state. And David, as described in the Bible, could not have been a figure. There's an article in this issue of Bar that describes a dig that's been conducted by an archaeologist, an Israeli archaeologist, who up to now has only participated in prehistoric digs, but is now on the verge of retirement and wanted to be involved in a different kind of dig. So he has been working on a site, Kirbet Kiyafa. And his name is Yossi Garfinkel. In excavating this site, he's discovered that there is only one occupation layer until Hellenistic times, which is quite unusual. Generally speaking, the cities in the area of Palestine were sites that were well suited to habitation, and people would live in that place and build their houses, etc. And at some point in time, they would level those houses and start over, kind of an urban renewal project. Either that or it was leveled for them by neighbors. But one way or another, they tend to layer themselves, and there will be several different what are called occupation layers. At this particular site, there's only one occupation layer. And it was determined that the pottery from this site matches well with what's called the Iron 2A period, which is the period that's associated with the time of David. So it's about 1,000. It's usually thought to be about 1,000 BC. The minimalists would say that that layer dates to about 800 BC and is well after the time of David. But at the site, they found a number of olive pits, and olive pits can be carbon-14 dated. And so carbon-14 dating was done on these olive pits, and it was concluded that the dates come between 1000 BC and 920 BC with considerable degree of certainty. So the archaeologist has concluded that this city must have been founded between 1000 and 970 BC. is significant because this is a well-fortified city. It has two city gates, which is unusual. One city gate is typical, two indicating that this is a fairly significant outpost. And the walls that surrounded the city were made up of large ashlars, large stones, some of them up to 5 tons in weight. To construct such a city requires considerable resources as well as considerable organization. And so this city, which according to carbon-14 dating dates to 1000 to 970, required the existence of a state in order to be constructed. That's what the archaeologist is arguing. So if all of this stands up, and I know from reading Barr that in the next issue there'll be people who will say, yeah, but, and it'll take a while for it to be discussed. But if the findings hold up, then this would be evidence, and this would be the second site where there's significant evidence that a state must have existed in Israel at the time of David. And at the other site, Tel Dan, there was actually an inscription referring to the dynasty of the house of David. Another thing with respect to this particular find that's interesting is they found an ostracon. An ostracon is a piece of broken pottery, and they used pieces of broken pottery to write notes on. It was their post-it version of post-its. And this is written in an early Hebraic script. And if that's true, if that holds up to scrutiny, then that would be the oldest Hebrew inscription that has ever been found. And the archaeologist is not telling us what it says yet. He wants to look at it a few more times. But it's interesting that the evidence seems to be coming in that the time of David, Israel did indeed have an organized state, and that David may very well have been a historic figure. And if I may be so bold as to predict, I think that there will be further finds that will confirm this as time goes on. Archaeologists and archaeology in general in Israel is becoming more active, I would say, and more productive. That they may not be doing as much digging, but they're getting more information per dig than they have gotten in the past. So that's very interesting. The other thing that I have long thought, and I really hope that it is true, I think that someday in the not too distant future, there will be found in Israel a cache of writings that dates back to hopefully before 500 BC. Caches of writings have been found in all of the other major civilizations that have been unearthed in the ancient Near East, except in Israel. And so I'm hopeful, optimistic that will be found, because I think that will be very significant. Okay, so that's my archaeological update. Let me just bring us up to date in 1 Samuel. Just review it a little bit. It's more for my sake probably than for your sake, but it's been a while since we were looking at 1 Samuel, and I want to look at things in context. The first part of 1 Samuel deals with the anointing of Saul as the first king of Israel, anointed by Samuel. And Saul was a very promising candidate for king. He looked the part, he acted the part. And he became the king of Israel. He was respected. He became, gradually, he became respected by the other Israelites, accepted as their king. And he led them in their conflict with their neighbors, in particular with against the Philistines, and did so successfully early on. But as it turned out, Saul was not devoted to God heart and soul, and that becomes clear in the narrative, that Saul was always insecure in his position, always seemed to be afraid that he would lose his power and authority, and seemed to think that his power and authority rested in the people of Israel. And as a result, he made decisions that were calculated to please the people rather than please God, his Lord. As a result, Samuel anointed another person. He anointed David, son of Jesse, as a replacement for Saul, that David would rise up and become the king in Saul's place. It wasn't made clear when this would happen, how this would happen. It was just clear that David was going to, had been anointed and would take the place of God's anointed in Israel. And David initially has a meteoric rise. He attracts the attention of Saul very early on as a young man, when he kills a Philistine who was of huge stature, Goliath, killed him just with a sling and stones and unarmed. Kills Goliath, and the Israelites are able to rout the Philistines as a result of that. David then has other successes against the Philistines and ends up marrying Saul's daughter, Micah. As a result of this rapid rise in popularity that David enjoyed, Saul began to feel threatened in his position as king and was more and more committed to finding David and killing him. And David became aware that Saul was looking for the opportunity to kill him, and David is forced to flee. Saul, meanwhile, loses his sanity, becomes more and more crazy sometimes, and it seems to come and go in severity. But he loses touch with reality to one degree or another and is determined to kill David. Saul's son, Jonathan, befriends David. Jonathan is convinced that David is going to become king, and Jonathan sees that as a good thing. And we'll run into another instance where Jonathan talks about that in chapter 24. And with Jonathan's help, David determines that Saul does indeed want to kill him, and that David does indeed need to get out of Jerusalem, and David flees. And he goes to the small town of Nob, where he stops and talks to the priests and takes the showbread, because he has fled in such haste that he has no food and no weapons. He gets the showbread and a sword, and then he and a few of his men flee on. Saul later discovers that David had been there, and Saul has everyone there killed. David goes on to Gath, which is a Philistine city, but there they recognize him, and David's life is in danger, so he feigns madness in order to escape from them without being taken and killed there. He moves from there into the Judean wilderness to Adullam, hides in caves there until some others come and meet him. Then he decides it's not safe there. He moves to Moab, which is on the other side of the Arabah. It's in the desert area to the east of Judah. He stays there. He takes his parents there, and they end up staying there until David's whole period of flight is over. But a prophet tells him to return to Judah. So David can't stay in Moab. He comes back to Judah, into the Judean desert. And he stays in the wilderness of Judah until the action in this next chapter begins. But David is having a difficult time finding a safe place. If he goes into the Philistine area, he's an enemy of the Philistines, and he can't stay there. If he's in Moab, God won't let him stay there. If he's in Judah, there are always people around that are willing to inform on him to Saul, and Saul comes looking. So he's always on the run. He has collected around him a small army of misfits. Starts out around 400 men, and it grows to about 600, as we'll see in this passage. And this group that has gathered around him are described in 1 Samuel 22:2. It says, "And everyone who is in distress, and everyone who is in debt, and everyone who is discontented gathered to him, and he became captain over them. Now there were about 400 men with him." So it's this little army of disaffected misfits that have gathered around him and are supporting him. Chapter 23, first five verses. "Then they told David, saying, 'Behold, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah and are plundering the threshing floors.' So David inquired of the Lord, saying, 'Shall I go and attack these Philistines?' And the Lord said to David, 'Go and attack the Philistines and deliver Keilah.' But David's men said to him, 'Behold, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we go to Keilah against the ranks of the Philistines?' Then David inquired of the Lord once more. And the Lord answered him and said, 'Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will give the Philistines into your hand.' So David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines. And he led away their livestock and struck them with a great slaughter. Thus David delivered the inhabitants of Keilah." So David's in the wilderness of Judah with this small army of the disaffected. And apparently the people of Keilah get word to David that they are being threatened by the Philistines. David's probably the only Israelite military force that's in the area. Keilah is probably an Israelite settlement, but from the text, it's apparent that it's not a part of the tribe of Judah. So it's probably other Israelites that are living there. And it has come under attack by the Philistines. It is not far from Philistine territory. They've come in, and apparently they want to plunder the harvest. They're plundering the threshing floors. So they want to collect all of the harvest that they can from the people of Keilah. So they've appealed to David, and David does as was common in ancient Israel, as well as the other ancient cultures. He inquires of God to see whether this would be an appropriate action for him to take. And it was common for them to inquire of God as to whether to go to war. So he asks, and how does he ask? Apparently he's asking by means of the Urim and Thummim. We'll see later, and I mentioned just before in chapter 22, that when the priests of Nob, who had helped David, they had provided him with food and with weapons. When Saul found out that they had helped him, Saul killed them all, except for one of the priestly family who was able to escape. And that's Abiathar. And he escapes and flees to David and joins David. And he brings with him the ephod. The ephod is a garment that the priests would wear, and it has pockets, and in the pockets it has the Urim and the Thummim. And the Urim and Thummim are some kind of token. I don't know what they did with them, whether they flipped them like a coin or what they did with them, but they did something with these tokens that provided yes or no answers to their questions. And apparently that's what David had done. that he, when it says he inquired of the Lord, apparently he had Abiathar use the Urim and Thummim to determine whether David should go against the Philistines. And the answer that came back was yes. So David is ready to go attack the Philistines at Keilah, but his men say, wait a minute. We're in danger here in Judah, where we can flee from Saul whenever he comes. Why would we want to take on a more formidable force in the Philistines without any good reason to do so? So they demand a second opinion. So David inquires of the Lord again, and the Lord answered him and says, arise, go down to Keilah, for I will give the Philistines into your hand. So the second opinion was the same. God says, go to Keilah, and David and his men do so. They defeat the Philistines, drive them out, and take the livestock that the Philistines had. It's not clear why the Philistines had livestock there, but that's what the text says. Next section, starting with verse 6. Now it came about when Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, fled to David at Keilah, that he came down with the ephod in his hand. When it was told Saul that David had come to Keilah, Saul said, God has delivered him into my hand, for he shut himself in by entering a city with double gates and bars. So Saul summoned all the people for war to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. Now David knew that Saul was plotting evil against him, so he said to Abiathar the priest, bring the ephod here. Then David said, O Lord God of Israel, thy servant has heard for certain that Saul is seeking to come to Keilah to destroy the city on my account. Will the men of Keilah surrender me into his hand? Will Saul come down just as thy servant has heard? O Lord God of Israel, I pray, tell thy servant. And the Lord said, he will come down. Then David said, will the men of Keilah surrender me and my Lord into the hand of Saul? And the Lord said, they will surrender you. Then David and his men, about 600, arose and departed from Keilah, and they went wherever they could go. When it was told Saul that David had escaped from Keilah, he gave up the pursuit. And David stayed in the wilderness in the strongholds and remained in the hill country in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day, but God did not deliver him into his hand. So it's mentioning here at the very beginning that Abiathar had come to David with the ephod. So now David has this means by which to get counsel from God. Saul finds out that David is at Keilah, and Saul says, great, here's my chance. In the past, David had always been out in the open and had been very mobile, and Saul had to chase him, and David was always able to get away from him. But apparently, Saul sees this as a golden opportunity. David is inside a walled city. So Saul will go down and besiege that city, and David won't be able to slip away as he has done in the past. So Saul wants to take advantage of this opportunity and takes his army down to Keilah. David, it's not clear whether he anticipates this or whether he gets word of this, but David understands that Saul's likely to come and attack him in this particular situation. So David inquires of the Lord again. First of all, is Saul going to come after me? And God says, yes, he is. And David's second question is, are the people of Keilah going to turn me over to him? You need to recognize that in a siege situation, you need to have the solidarity and the tenacity of the people that are inside the city and are being besieged. Because otherwise, someone is going to do something to undermine your efforts to withstand the siege. Someone's going to help the enemy sooner or later because it gets miserable. as the siege progresses, you run out of food, you run out of water, and people get very desperate. So David needs to have the people of Keilah solidly behind him, otherwise this is doomed to failure. So he inquires of the Lord, are they going to stand behind me? And God says, nope. They're going to turn you over. So David knows that he can't stay in Keilah. So his men just take off, and they go in all directions. Clearly, this retreat is not planned. It was very hastily done, and they're just trying to escape as best they can. They take off, and once again, Saul is in a position of having to chase them, and that's a situation in which he is at the disadvantage. So Saul gives up trying to get them at Keilah, but he does begin to look for them throughout this wilderness of Ziph, seeks him every day, seeing if he can catch David in a position where he can capture him. But it says, God did not deliver him into his hand. One of the main themes through this section is, try as Saul might, God is clearly protecting David and keeping David from falling into Saul's hands. The next section. Now David became aware that Saul had come out to seek his life while David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David at Horesh and encouraged him in God. Thus he said to him, do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul my father shall not find you, and you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you. And Saul my father knows that also. So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and David stayed at Horesh while Jonathan went to his house. Jonathan was apparently Saul's leading commander. Jonathan was Saul's leading commander. And Jonathan is obviously here in southern Judah with Saul looking for David, helping him in that military effort. But Jonathan has already made a covenant with David. They are very good friends. Jonathan understands that David is going to become the king. David will replace Saul. And Jonathan is fine with that, which is amazing, because Jonathan would be the heir to the throne. Jonathan should be the rightful king after the death of Saul. But Jonathan understands what's going on and understands that David has been anointed by God, and that is okay with Jonathan. So Jonathan, at great risk, is coming out to meet with David and to encourage him and to reassure David that what David thinks to be the case is indeed the case, and that is David is going to be the king that replaces Saul. And curiously, he says, I will be next to you. So Jonathan's reaffirming his support of David. And he says, Saul, my father, knows that also. And we'll talk about this later, because there's a sense in which Saul knows this, and there's a sense in which Saul doesn't know this. So the two of them made another covenant, as they had done before. They reaffirmed their friendship for one another and their alliance. Then Jonathan returns, and David goes back to his stronghold. The next section. Then Ziphites came up to Saul at Gibeah, saying, is David not hiding with us in the strongholds of Horesh, on the hill of Hakilah, which is on the south of Jeshimon? Now then, O king, come down according to all the desire of your heart to do so, and our part shall be to surrender him into the king's hand. And Saul said, may you be blessed of the Lord, for you have had compassion on me. Go now, make more sure, and investigate, and see his place, where his haunt is, And who has seen him there? For I am told that he is very cunning. So look and learn about all the hiding places where he hides himself, and return to me with certainty, and I will go with you. And it shall come about, if he is in the land, that I will search him out, and among all the thousands of Judah. Okay, so some Ziphites, so some people who live in this area of Ziph, and they are probably of the tribe of Judah, so they are probably of David's own tribe. They have informed on David. They've told Saul that where David has been staying, and apparently are willing to help gain intelligence information for Saul, so that he can catch David. And Saul is elated. This is his chance, another chance, and a potential opportunity for him to capture David. Because now there are people here that are willing to cooperate with him who know David's movements, where he goes, where he hides, and can help him then to locate David and capture him. And notice the emphasis that Saul places on certainty. Go back and make sure where David goes and where he stays and all these sorts of things. Saul wants this opportunity not to slip away, and he wants certainty that he's going to be able to capture David this time. And once they come back with that kind of certain information, he'll come down with lots of help and capture David. Next section, then they arose and went to Ziph before Saul. Now David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon, in the Arabah to the south of Jeshimon. When Saul and his men went to seek him, they told David, and he came down to the rock and stayed in the wilderness of Maon. And when Saul heard it, he pursued David in the wilderness of Maon. And Saul went on one side of the mountain, and David and his men on the other side of the mountain. And David was hurrying to get away from Saul, for Saul and his men were surrounding David and his men to seize them. But a messenger came to Saul, saying, "Hurry and come, for the Philistines have made a raid on the land." So Saul returned from pursuing David and went to meet the Philistines. Therefore they called that place the Rock of Escape. And David went up from there and stayed in the strongholds of En-Gedi. So Saul comes down with his army. They're using the intelligence information that have been given to them by the people of Ziph. And they pursue David to the place where there is this mountain. And David and his men go on one side of it. Saul and his men go on the other side. But Saul has the advantage here somehow. I don't know exactly what the topography is. But Saul is able to get into a position where they've trapped David, and they're going to be able to surround David. So the intelligence information that he was given was of great advantage to him, and Saul has been able to trap David in the way that he had wanted to do so. But as things turn out, Saul has bad luck. A messenger comes and says that the Philistines have attacked, and Saul's attention is needed elsewhere urgently. And Saul is put in a position where he has to withdraw and deal with this attack by the Philistines in another part of Judah and let David go. So he had David almost in his grasp, and Saul is put in a situation where he has to leave and abandon the chase of David. One more time, God has come to David's aid and protected him. So David flees from that area where there are too many informants, and he goes to En-Gedi, which is an area just to the north of the Dead Sea. Chapter 24, verses 1 through 7. Now it came about when Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, saying, "Behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel, and went to seek David and his men in front of the rocks of the wild goats. And he came to the sheepfolds on the way, where there was a cave. And Saul went in to relieve himself. Now David and his men were sitting in the inner recesses of the cave. And the men of David said to him, "Behold, this is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I am about to give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it seems good to you.'" Then David arose and cut off the edge of Saul's robe secretly. And it came about that afterward that David's conscience bothered him because he had cut off the edge of Saul's robe. So he said to his men, "Far be it from me because of the Lord that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, since he is the Lord's anointed." And David persuaded his men with these words and did not allow them to rise up against Saul. And Saul arose, left the cave, and went on his way. So David is in this area just north of the Dead Sea, in the En Gedi area. And Saul had taken care of the Philistines and presumably had done so successfully, has come back now and is retaking his attempt to capture David. And Saul has to take a bathroom break. Saul goes into the cave. Presumably, he would have done this without any of his bodyguards with him. And presumably, this leaves him for a time defenseless. It just so happens that this cave is already occupied by David and some of his men. They're deeper in the cave. Saul doesn't know that they're there, but they see Saul come in, and it is an opportunity that is too good to be true. And so the men say, and it's not clear where the men got this, but it says, "This is the day which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I am about to give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it seems good to you.'" There's no place where that has been recorded, that God said that to David. So it's not clear where that comes from, whether such a thing was said to David by God or whether this is something that the men have come up with on their own. In any case, they are urging him to take advantage of this and to kill Saul. After all, Saul has been trying to kill David and pursuing him for an extended period of time now. And you can see that his men would see some legitimacy in this. David sneaks over and cuts the tassels off the end of Saul's robe. Those tassels would have been distinctive. Those tassels would have been his ID. Each person would have had tassels that would have indicated their tribe and their family and who they are as an individual. So they stole his driver's license. David stole his driver's license, essentially. Having done so, David feels bad, because he has done something that is disrespectful towards the anointed of God. Even though this anointed of God is one who's been trying to kill David, who has been highly unjust to God, to David, David recognizes he is nevertheless the man that God put on the throne of Israel, and he is still the king of Israel. He is still God's representative in the kingdom. And so David feels the need to be respectful towards Saul, and it regrets what he's done, because what he's done was not respectful. And so he wants to do no more than that, and he persuades his men in the cave that they ought not do anything further. The next section. Now afterward, David arose and went out of the cave and called after Saul, saying, "My lord the king." And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the ground and prostrated himself. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men, saying, 'Behold, David seeks to harm you'? Behold, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord had given you today into my hand in the cave. And some said to kill you, but my eye had pity on you. And I said, 'I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed.' Now, my father, see, indeed, see the edge of your robe in my hand. For in that I cut off the edge of your robe and did not kill you, know and perceive that there is no evil or rebellion in my hands, and I have not sinned against you, though you are lying in wait for my life to take it. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancients says, 'Out of the wicked comes forth wickedness,' but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom are you pursuing? A dead dog? A single flea? The Lord, therefore, be judge and decide between you and me. And may he see and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand." So David is going to use this tassel now. He wants to make a point to Saul. And I don't think the spirit here is one of taunting. He could have. David could have used this to taunt Saul. But I don't think that's the spirit of his comments here whatsoever. And I think it's significant that it says that David bowed with his face to the ground and prostrated himself. David is taking an action here, showing his respect for the king, for Saul. And he says, "Why do you listen to the words of men saying, 'Behold, David seeks to harm you'?" David's being very generous here. He's assuming that the reason that Saul is coming after him is that people have talked him into it, that people around him, around Saul, have convinced Saul that David wants to do harm to Saul. The text, I think, makes it clear that Saul didn't need encouragement to go after David. Saul has his own perspective on things, and he sees David as a threat to himself, quite apart from what others say. But there may very well have been people in the court that were encouraging him to see things from this perspective. Well, David only talks about these other people who are saying lies about David. And David says, "Why do you listen to them?" And then he uses the tassels. He says, "I could have killed you today. You were in a vulnerable position where I could have killed you. And to prove that that's the case, here are the tassels from your robe. And I could have done it, but I didn't do it." And this is proof that I am not a rebel. I am not intent on doing evil to you. And I have not sinned against you, though you are lying in wait for me, for my life, to take it. So he says, "Let God be a judge between us. Let him decide between us. My heart," David's claiming, "is pure. It's clean. I have done nothing wrong against you. I have no ill intent towards you." So he raises the question, he says, "May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you." And then he says, "It makes no sense that you would spend so much time chasing after me when I am so insignificant." And then he calls upon God to be the judge between them. and to deliver him from Saul's hand. Okay, next section, Saul responds. Now it came about when David had finished speaking these words to Saul that Saul said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" Then Saul lifted up his voice and wept. And he said to David, "You are more righteous than I, for you have dealt well with me, while I have dealt wickedly with you. And you have declared today that you have done good to me, that the Lord delivered me into your hand, and yet you did not kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safely? May the Lord therefore reward you with good in return for what you have done to me this day. And now behold, I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. So now swear to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not destroy my name from my father's household." And David swore to Saul, and Saul went to his home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. So Saul recognizes the kindness of David's act, the graciousness of David's act, that David did indeed spare the life of Saul when David could have taken it easily. And so he says, "You are a more righteous man than I." And he recognizes that if David truly saw Saul as his enemy, it would have been both justifiable and it would have been wise for David to have killed him in that situation. But he didn't. And so at this time, Saul recognizes that God's hand is on David. And David is going to be the next king. David is going to be Saul's replacement. And this is the first time that Saul actually says this. He says, "I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand." Then he asks David to promise that David will not kill all of his kill his descendants. It would have been common when there is a dynastic change or another family comes in and takes the kingship to kill all the members of the old king's family, because they will always be a threat. They will always be looking for an opportunity to reclaim the throne and reestablish their dynasty. So that would have been very common practice. Saul's aware of that. So he asked David to promise that he won't do that. We will see in a few chapters, actually early chapters of 2 Samuel, that David keeps that promise, that Mephibosheth comes to David and seeks refuge, and David takes him in and cares for him the rest of his life. So Saul recognizes what's happened here, recognizes how merciful David has been, and recognizes that that indicates that David is not indeed out to get him. And Saul goes away to his home, and David goes back to his stronghold. Clearly, the relationship is not completely reestablished here. David's going back to his stronghold, and Saul's going back to his home. But there is a recognition here on Saul's part of what God seems to be doing, that David is going to replace him. And a recognition that David is the more righteous. But as we'll see, that's a temporary recognition. There are a couple of things that I'd like to observe in these two chapters. The first is one that I've talked about before, and I mentioned briefly as we were going through the chapters. It is interesting to me to look at the contrast in the response to David that you get from Saul as opposed to Jonathan. Both of them, at some level, understand that David has been selected by God to replace Saul as king. Saul is unwilling to actually recognize that fact and come to embrace that as a true thing that's going to happen. Saul sees David as a threat, and Saul wants to kill David and goes to great length to try to do so, and apparently is unwilling to recognize that God is at work here and God is going to protect David. There is nothing that Saul can do to kill David. And the text makes it clear that God is going to great lengths to protect David in various ways and various circumstances and to frustrate Saul's efforts. But Saul won't recognize the significance of that fact and continues in his attempts and is more and more deluded in his attempts to try to get David. There are moments where Saul seems to realize what's going on, but then he slips back and denies that that's the case and chases after David some more. Jonathan, on the other hand, is steadfast in his recognition that David is going to become the king. And even though it is to Jonathan's loss that David will become king, Jonathan sees that as genuinely a good thing, that God is at work in this, and that what God is doing is good and proper. And Jonathan is willing to step down in order for that to happen. Jonathan's attitude here is truly remarkable, and it is consistent as opposed to Saul's, which wavers. It is also interesting to look at David's attitude towards his situation. David knows that he has been anointed. He apparently knows that he will take Saul's place as king. But on a day-to-day basis, his life is constantly in danger. And David is constantly having to take action to save his life. He doesn't just say, well, it's God has said it, it's in God's hands, I'm protected, I don't have to do anything. That's not his attitude whatsoever. His attitude is, what step makes sense next to take in this particular situation? But David seems to be overall confident that this will work out, but there are lots of situations that are quite dire and where it looks like David might lose his life. The other thing that I would like to point out in this passage is that this goes on for a long period of time for David. The period of time that Saul is after him and trying to kill him extends over a period of years. It's not clear how many years, but it is clear that it's in the years scale of magnitude. So David is fearing for his life and running away constantly from dangers over this very long period of time. It is very stressful. There are 8 of the Psalms that were written by David with respect to this period of time when he's fleeing from Saul. There are at least 8. There are 2 more that could be also. And all of them, to one degree or another, express his inner anguish as he's trying to escape from Saul. Let me just read one of them. It's Psalm 54. This was written on the occasion of when the Ziphites informed Saul that David was in their area and that they would help Saul to find David. I'll just read it. The other Psalms are similar and express similar kinds of attitudes. Save me, O God, by thy name, and vindicate me by thy power. Hear my prayer, O God. Give ear to the words of my mouth. For strangers have risen against me, and violent men have sought my life. They have not set God before them. Behold, God is my helper. The Lord is the sustainer of my soul. He will recompense the evil to my foes. Destroy them in thy faithfulness. Willingly I will sacrifice to thee. I will give thanks to thy name, O Lord, for it is good. For he has delivered me from all trouble, and my eye has looked with satisfaction upon my enemies. So there are 8 to 10 psalms, most of them longer, all expressing that same kind of angst over his situation and a sense of injustice, and that he is being pursued by people who have no reason to pursue him. And this goes on for years. The keeping track of the time scale in the Old Testament, I think, is very helpful. I find it reassuring. As you read the accounts, it's not clear how much time is passing between each paragraph. But sometimes the length of time between paragraphs is years or tens of years. And if you dial that into the equation, you realize that some of these things that the patriarchs suffered were over very long periods of time. I think of my life as going in seasons, that there are seasons when I have a particular set of problems that God seems to be facing me with. And I like to have a set of problems for a week or less. I can do a week. I can do 2 weeks sometimes. But my what has been made abundantly clear to me over the years, as I have gotten older, is that God likes longer seasons. And that the seasons typically have to be measured in years rather than weeks. That a particular set of problems that I'm dealing with will generally last years and far longer than I would like them to last. But God's working on a completely different time scale. He apparently is trying to achieve purposes in our lives that require major surgery rather than just a superficial incision. It's major surgery that he's working on our souls, and that takes a lot of time, and oftentimes it takes a lot of hurt and pain. And God is not averse to that, because the purposes that he's bringing about, the things that he's accomplishing, are well worth that. And he's therefore willing to put us through that. David was subjected to years of fearing for his life on a daily basis. I don't know exactly what God was trying to accomplish in David's life by doing that, but I can only assume that God was fulfilling a worthwhile purpose in doing that, and that there was no other good way for that to be accomplished. Okay. Questions? Comments?
Thank you. Uh-huh. Why was it that Jonathan was so convinced that God wanted David to be king, or that he would be king? And why was it that Saul should have known that he would be king?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was thinking about that, and I thought about talking on that, but decided I didn't know enough to talk about that. It seems to me that as human beings, God made us to be knowers. And there's a curiosity that has been built into us that to one degree or another is always there and will always be there. It's just a part of us. And it's that kind of curiosity that drives us to want to do science, try to figure out how the world's put together and how it operates. Similarly, I think to one degree or another, we have a curiosity to figure out what God is doing in history as well. That, and just to take our current financial crisis as an example, I can't help but wonder, what is this? Where is it going, and what is God doing with it? What's his intention for it? And I do think about that, and I do try to figure that out. I don't know how good I am at figuring that out. But with God's help, I think it is possible to get glimpses of what God is doing in history. And from time to time, we do get those glimpses. And some people get better glimpses than other people get. I have to assume, and I think that those who understand who God is and what he's doing in general are better positioned to make sense of those things than people who don't understand that. I think Jonathan was able to put together the pieces better because he understood who God is better and understood better what God's purposes are. Saul was in some ways in a better position. He had better information probably than even Jonathan had, but understood God less well and didn't like the direction that history was going and was therefore inclined to interpret it a different way. So I think it's something along those lines that Jonathan just understands, is able to put the data better together better because he understands who God is better and what God's purposes might be.
In terms of the character and purposes of God and the data that was presented to them, do you think there might be a connection between David's presentation of his demonstration of his mercy and David's, you know, demonstration of his faithfulness to Saul, and then Saul's proclamation that now I know that you shall surely be king?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, what Saul is essentially admitting is, I see that you are a better man than I, and that you deserve to be king.
Yes.
And that was following on the heels of what David did by, you know, not killing him when he had the chance.
Yes.
So do you think there might be a connection there in terms of God's character or God's...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Earlier, David was first impressed with... I mean, Jonathan was first impressed with David when David killed Goliath. And it wasn't just the killing of Goliath, but it was David's attitude, David's values. It was everything about the way that David presented himself that struck Jonathan. And I think that made a greater impression on Jonathan than it did on Saul, as being, this is someone special.
Thank you, David.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to the archaeological update.
Mm-hmm.
It's been many years since I've read Barr, but it just strikes me. Do we have a similar situation in the field of archaeology that we have in any other field of research in this life, that you have people whose visions are prejudiced because of their anti-supernatural bias, let's just put it that way. And do you have any hopes that the field of archaeology will be able to retain any sense of objectivity or not be tempted to, say, mess with the data, you know, plant certain things in certain places or some other ways not be objective or have integrity because there is an underlying bias?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of the interpretations of the archaeological data go in the direction that they go because of the presuppositions of the interpreters, and that there is an anti-biblical bias that dominates in the academic world in general and certainly in archaeology. I don't think that the archaeologists are devious. I think there may be some deviousness that happens, but generally speaking, I don't think they're devious. I don't think they are aware of their presuppositions and how those presuppositions are influencing the way they interpret things. But I think as more information is made available, some of the positions and interpretations that have dominated in the past will no longer be tenable. That more information will come along that will make it clearer and clearer that David truly was a historic figure and that he did more or less meet the description of him in the Old Testament. I think that's going to happen. And I think anybody is going to say, is going to have to nod their head, yeah, I guess that's right. But the pattern that we'll see is will be the pattern that we've seen before, and that is they will retreat to, David existed, but that doesn't mean that the Bible's inspired. It doesn't mean that Abraham existed, et cetera, et cetera. But what I read Barr, I read a few other books, so I'm not a scholar. I'm not real knowledge about archaeology, but just as an armchair observer. The trend that I'm seeing is there is, and this is true not just in archaeology, but it's true in the study of ancient history in general, that the pendulum had swung over, say, in the 50s and 60s, that oral traditions, historical traditions passed down through cultures were thoroughly unreliable. But there have been a number of rather dramatic discoveries that have occurred over the last 3 or 4 decades that are showing that oral traditions are far more more reliable than people had given them credit, that these histories that have come down, some written, that are also more reliable than we've been giving them credit. And so the pendulum has swung back to the place now where you see people granting credibility to these oral traditions or these written traditions that wouldn't have been there before. So I find that interesting. The other thing I find interesting is a lot of the archaeology that's being conducted now in Israel in particular is being done by Israelis. And most of them are not believers, but they take Jewish tradition seriously. And they see the finds as, to their surprise in many cases, as confirming the tradition that's been passed down. And that's not, they don't see that as terribly problematic. They're just seeing their tradition as being more solid than people had given credit in the past. So I'm finding that very interesting and very encouraging. And in the field of archaeology, they have found new techniques that are making it possible for them to conduct, well, as I mentioned before, I don't think there are more digs happening, but the digs that are being done are far more productive because they have ways of predetermining whether a site is going to have helpful information or not before they even start digging. And they can do that with satellite photography and all kinds of things. So I think that more information is going to come out in the near future, in the next 5 to 10 years, and it will be overwhelmingly confirming of the biblical record.
If the current conflict doesn't get out of hand.
Well, I think the current conflict will just change. I think the minimalists are going to lose very soon here, but they will retrench in a different spot.
I meant the war going on over
there. Oh, that war. Yeah, that war also. Yes.
Thank you. Uh-huh.
Just a quick one. Do you have by any chance with you the numbers of the other psalms that you mentioned?
Mm-hmm. Some of them. Well, 52 is one of them, 54, 57, 142. And then the others are I'm just pulling out of my hat. I think 18, 36. I don't remember the others.
David, I had a question about the juxtaposition of what Jack was just talking about in Jesus' prayer before his crucifixion. Mm-hmm. And David's, the Psalms are somewhat, are often disturbing to me sometimes, mm-hmm. or just confusing, because our example of Christ is, Lord, let this cup pass from me, yet not my will but thine. Mm-hmm. And David over and over again is saying, destroy my enemies, destroy my enemies.
Yes.
And he has a different idea of what God has in store for him, but it seems like he has no room for... the Bible calls David a man after God's own heart, and yet he seems to be so emotional and irrational and impassioned, mm-hmm. and he seems to allow no room for... maybe God has planned that his enemies should destroy him, even though his understanding of God's purposes are different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a complicated question. And another one I thought about talking about, but didn't because I didn't know enough. David is unique here. That if... I mean, I don't think that what Jesus says is different in spirit from what David is saying. I think they're compatible. That David, too, is, I think, could also say, not my will, but thy will be done. And I think it is also true that Jesus could have said, destroy my enemies, just as Jesus could have said that, just as David does. But what we see consistently in the Psalms is, in this kind of context, is God destroy my enemies. David can say that in a way that I could not say that. David is in a unique position. David is the anointed of God. And there's something unique about being in that kind of position. And that is... that if someone is the anointed of God, then we ought to relate to them with the respect that is due to the anointed of God. If we do not relate to them with the respect that is due to the anointed of God, we don't know who God is. There's something wrong with my heart if I don't do that. And David seems to understand that how people respond to him is indicative of how they respond to God. And I think we see that in Saul and Jonathan, by the way. That Jonathan, his response to David is to recognize that David is the special anointed of God, and I ought give him the respect that is due to him. Saul won't give him that respect, that same respect. And that stems from a heart attitude towards God himself. So I think that's, one has to read those Psalms with keeping that in mind. That it's not so much God destroy them because they dissed me, but God destroy them because they dissed you. Because it's everything they're doing is coming from the wrong kind of heart. There's wickedness there. So it has to be under. You have to understand that that's the context. And I could not say that same thing. If someone disses me, that's not the same as dissing God. That's a whole different thing. One more, and then I've got to let the kids go.
The point in which David says that God will avenge, I don't have the words in front of me, but that one sentence where he says, God will avenge me, mm-hmm. that's a huge statement on I had the chance, I laid it down, not my will, but God's
yes,
will be done.
Exactly.
There's two men standing there, and one of them's going to be king, and it's almost like David saying, the hour is running out on your kingdom, and still Saul walks away from it.
Yes.
I mean, that must have been...
Yes.
An incredible, tumultuous moment in Saul's mind, mm-hmm. knowing that here's an anointed man, and they're settling on the fact that God's going to make this decision, mm-hmm. and David didn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, David's content with that.
Right.
David's completely content with that, and Saul...
I mean, that would have must have drove him... He was already insane, but it must have just drove him nuts.
Yes. Okay, thank you.